sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Justice. Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Will.
Peace.
Movement.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
progress,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings with my co-host Gord Barnes, and we have a special guest, Barzan Sleeman. Barzan is from Kurdistan and is studying international affairs at the U of R. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you so much.
And before we dive into this stuff, there's one important thing that I'd like to mention first, and that is our Look and Listen lottery. And it's coming up on May the 8th. I've got to have a look here. Yes, it's May the 8th, and that'll be a Friday. And on that day, the draw is going to be made for our grand prize, which is a trip for two to New York City, which consists of the airfare for two and a four-star hotel for three nights, Mets or Yankees baseball tickets, tickets for a motor coach tour of Manhattan and a tour of Radio City Music Hall, plus $1,000 cash to spend any way you want. Sounds like a good holiday to me, Gord.
Great one.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm not eligible.
Oh.
But you are.
All right.
Second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Wagenli Rickert Travel. Third prize is a getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa. It's a two-night stay, which includes breakfast and dinner at Harwood's Dining Room and a $100 gaming credit at Casino Regina and Moose Jaw. So that sounds like fun, too. So tickets are only $20, and there's just 1,200 that are being sold, and we're, of course, there aren't that many available now because we sold a bunch of them. So if you want your ticket, you got to get on it right now. You can buy them here at the radio station. You can call the station at 525-7274 during regular office hours, and we can look after you with a credit card. You can come down and pay in person, or find a programmer. If you know a programmer, they'll have tickets for you to buy from them, and they'd be happy to sell them to you. So that's pretty exciting.
It's a great way to support community radio and the diversity of the music and spoken word programs. And I can tell you, I got my tickets and a few for gifts last week when I was here at the station. So I've got my opportunity to win, I guess, is there, but I know there's other people who I'm sure are hoping to make that big trip. So good luck to everybody who gets a ticket.
Exactly. And, of course, that's how we pay for the improvements that that happen at the station here on a regular basis.
So, Barzan, it's great to have you back on the program today. And you were saying it's the end of the school year for you. You've got all your papers done at university, and looking forward to a few exams now.
Yeah, thank you for having me, first of all. And yeah, this is it. My first year has gone so fast that it's just hard to believe that how fast it went.
Great stuff.
And I'm actually excited for summer. There's nothing special. I'm just gonna work.
Uh-huh.
But I'm looking forward to the nice weather
and some warm weather too.
Hopefully, we hope so.
I was gonna say that's we'll see how that goes.
So we thought we'd spend as much of the program as we can on discussions about what's happening in terms of human rights issues for people who are Kurdish background. And you know, the Kurdish people are in a number of different countries, primarily in the Middle East, but obviously people have had to move to other countries as well. So maybe just to begin the program, do you want to just give our listeners an update as to, you know, a bit of an overview where people do live in the Middle East who are Kurdish background in terms of particular countries? And obviously, people, as you say, have had to travel to other places like Canada as well. But do you want to start there?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, I'm from Kurdistan, which is a region that covers the north part of Iraq, the north part of Syria, northeast Iran, and southeast Turkey. Now, my family is actually from the north part of Iraq. However, I'm from the north part of Syria, Al-Hasaka region. And issues have taken place, human rights issues have taken place throughout after World War I and all these countries after the breakup of the country Kurdistan. And so now we don't have official country. But in terms of Kurdistan, in the beginning of 1991, after the first Gulf War, the Kurds managed to gain autonomy in the north part of Iraq, and officially recognized in 2003 by all world organizations, which includes the United States, the European Union, and other world organizations.
And people have obviously had to leave even the region in many cases, like your own family. Are there very many Kurdish people in Canada who have settled here?
There are approximately about 8,000 Kurds in Canada. Well, actually, there's not it's hard to say the significant number because, for example, many Kurds, for example, are in Toronto.
Right.
Or the biggest Kurdish communities are Toronto, Montreal, and Calgary. So there's not a significant number because they're scattered all over Canada. Mm-hmm. But the major three communities are Toronto, Montreal, and Calgary. Mm-hmm. So there's approximately around 8,000 to 10,000 Kurds living in Canada.
And people would have obviously had to leave and go to Europe as well, and as refugees in United States, other countries that are willing to accept refugees?
Yes, the biggest population of the Kurdish people is actually in Germany, and they're saying that estimations around it's from 900,000 to 1.1 million or something like that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a large population in Germany.
Yeah, and most of them actually have been there for longest time ever, maybe like 30, 40 years, even more than that, because of the prosecutions that they faced during Saddam Hussein or during the Turkish regime or the Islamic Revolution in Iran.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a significant anniversary right now is coming up, and that is the terrible consequences of the attack where Saddam Hussein used chemical warfare in the northern part of Iraq on the Kurdish people, and so many people lost their lives. It was a tragedy. 1988, where I understand that 4,500 villages were actually destroyed. And from one of the reports I was looking at just last night, over 182,000 people were killed at that point. I was noticing there's a film that's going to be screened at on a premiere basis. It's called 1001 Apples. It's going to be screened this weekend, marking the 26th anniversary of the chemical attack. It's going to be at the the London Kurdish Film Festival. Be an interesting one to see if we could arrange to screen here
for sure.
In Saskatchewan.
For sure, yeah, that would be very interesting because that would get a good idea, a good sense of understanding, like people would understand where the Kurds are coming from and who the Kurdish people are, because many people do not understand who the Kurds are. For example, when I say I'm from Kurdistan, they don't understand where that is. Mm-hmm. And then when I refer to them as Northern Iraq, they get, you know, scared, you know, and they are in shock that they're saying, oh, you're from Northern Iraq. And then I say to them, no, it's Northern Iraq. It's been a safe region since 2003. We gained autonomy in 1991, but since 2003, we have prosperity and peace. And we have booming economy, so.
Since 2003,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because after 1991, there was still an embargo from Saddam Hussein on the Kurdistan region. But after 2003, when the removal of Saddam Hussein, the Kurds gained more autonomy in terms of recognition by the United States, by the European Union. So now they're recognized as, you know, autonomous region, officially autonomous region.
But you were saying as well that a more current concern with respect to Iraq and northern Iraq and the autonomous region is a slashing of the budget by the central government. Have I got correct understanding of that?
Yes. The Iraqi government has actually cut the budget of the Kurdistan region. We receive a 17% of the budget. Now, since 2003, according to the Kurdistan regional government, the Kurds have only received around 8 to 10% of the budget. Mm-hmm. And they made up for the rest of their budget by selling their own oil. Now, there is a clash here because the Baghdad, the central government in Baghdad, they have cut the budget. They have cut the 17% budget of the Kurdistan region.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that the Kurdistan region must produce 4,000 barrels of oil every day. Otherwise, we're going to cut their budget. And President Barzani has stated that this is worse than gassing the Kurds. This is as worse as gassing the Kurds.
So, everybody who does follow current events in Iraq would be concerned about the continuing conflict that exists, not necessarily in northern Iraq itself, but because you're saying that things are perhaps a little safer there now.
Yeah.
But post the war, certainly the conflict has continued for people who live, for example, even in Baghdad, and that's got to be a very serious situation. I don't know, would there be Kurdish people who live in Baghdad still, or have they, for the most part, are they in northern Iraq?
Yes, estimation by the Kurdistan regional government, there's around 10,000 failure Kurds in Iraq, in Baghdad, sorry.
Is that right?
Yes, and the situation in Iraq right now, it's like oil spill, you know, like what I mean by that. It's like, for example, you have the Prime Minister Maliki coming in and taking all the power, and basically it's rising up to a dictatorship again, and nobody is accepting that. For example, the Kurds are not accepting that, the Sunnis are not accepting that, and the Shias are building their power in the rest of Iraq, and then they want to control also the north part of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They want, for example, our government says we are still a part of Iraq. However, we want to be economically independent.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to send our own oil. And according to the Kurdistan regional government, we have the right to do that and based in the constitution of Iraq. But the Iraqi government doesn't abide by its constitution.
So the Iraqi conflict that is existing, for example, in places outside of the autonomous region,
yes,
that you're referring to, must be a real concern for people who are the Kurdish people. And you say there's 10,000 of them in Baghdad itself.
Yeah.
Would there be Kurdish people in other parts of Iraq beyond the two that we've mentioned?
Yes. A note that we have to make as well is, for example, we have disputed regions, which are actually Kurdish regions. You have like 80 to 90% Kurdish people living there, but they're still not a part of the Kurdistan regional government. So they're outside the boundaries of the Kurdistan regional government, and they're also outside the boundaries of the Iraqi central government. And both claim that they have the right to that region, like they claim the regions.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a referendum that was supposed to go on in 2007 that was supposed to let the people of these regions decide whether they want to be part of Kurdistan or they want to become part of Iraq. And the referendum has always been delayed because the Iraqi government knows that if a referendum goes through, those regions will join up the Kurdistan region. Mm-hmm. Another thing to mention is the big problem why the referendum has keep delaying is because Kirkuk province, and Kirkuk lies just 300 kilometers from Baghdad, so it's closer to the Kurdistan region. It's actually Kurdish, and the Baghdad government says Kirkuk is Iraq because it's one of the largest oil cities in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of the program as well, you were talking about where you're actually from yourself in terms of a part of Syria.
Yeah.
And the conflict there in Syria in the last couple of years has just been a human rights disaster, and we've had lots of discussions on this program about it, and so many people have had to leave Syria as refugees. Many people have, you know, the numbers of people who have died in that conflict is terrible, and people have had to leave either into Iraq, Lebanon, or other adjacent countries as refugees. Maybe you can speak to that a little bit. You know, Amnesty International's own focus is around the human rights issues, and that's what we're trying to explore today. And maybe you can sort of shed a little bit of perspective on that as well.
Yeah, for sure. For example, like the north part of Syria, there's predominantly Kurdish people living there, but there's also Christian people, Arab people. So what was happening was during the revolution of Syria in 2011, you understand the situation. It became a civil war. Mm-hmm. It started with the uprising, then it ended with a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our people, they thought that, you know, it's a better idea to, you know, protect ourselves and everybody in those regions.
Mm-hmm.
So what they came up with is a plan to establish autonomous region in the north part of Syria. So recently in January of this year, they declared autonomy in three provinces, Ain al-Arab, which is Kobani, Jazeera, and Afrin.
Mm-hmm.
And Afrin is just close to Aleppo's province.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is the Islamic extremists, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, they're attacking the Kurdish people.
Mm-hmm.
from the other parts of Syria they're trying to take over the Kurdish areas. And one main problem of this is because nobody wants to accept the Kurdish people as people. They thinking that, you know, they want to take Islamic part. Like, for example, the IS, they want to take control of these regions, mainly because they don't want Kurds to establish a country in these mm-hmm. regions. Another thing is we give rights to our women. So, mm-hmm. for example, if you see like our fighters, the People's Protection Units, or in Kurdish, YAPAGE, most of their commanders and most of their fighters are women.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Islamic are attacking it because we are given rights to Christians, we have rights for Kurds, we have rights for women, we have rights for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem of that is no world organization has recognized our autonomous region,
mm-hmm.
because they're saying it's undemocratic. And actually, in reality, that's the only democratic part of Syria. Democracy in Syria begins with the Kurdish people. It doesn't matter which political party they're affiliated with. Democracy in Syria begins with the Kurds, because the Kurds have been a major part of Syria, and the Kurds have been a major player in Syria in establishing peace.
And the people who are Kurdish who have had to leave Syria and as refugees and go for example, into Iraq, are where are they living in Iraq relative to the autonomous region? Are they in that part of the country or in camps somewhere else?
Yes, the refugees in the ones that are living in Iraq, they're actually living in the borders of the autonomous Kurdish region in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And there's approximately 200,000 refugees right now in Kurdistan, mm-hmm. Iraq. And most of them live, like, there's many camps. So in the capital city, outside the capital city in the Hulk region and in Sulaymaniyah region. And the thing is, like, most people right now are actually going back to help fight the Islamic extremists, because once the Islamic extremists take over these regions, then it's just going to be a disaster.
Mm.
It's impossible to say that there's going to be peace in Syria without the Kurdish people.
So that's got to be a concern in terms of the continuing conflict, in terms of people going back and forth and how well those people are getting by on a day-to-day basis. It's a real significant issue.
Yes, for sure. And there's also political problems between Kurdish parties, like, for example, the PYD and the KDP. PYD is Democratic Union Party, and KDP, Kurdistan Democratic Party. So they have different views, and they have a little bit of disagreements, which is not good, because mm-hmm. it's, in my own view, I think that they should be united
mm-hmm.
for the people's will, because mm-hmm. people are crossing the borders, and now there's border issues. And the KDP has strong ties with Turkey, mainly because they sell their oil into they're trying to sell their oil into world markets.
Okay. Wow. I think we're getting really close to the break here, mm-hmm. but from what I understand, but I just, before we go there, perhaps I could just shift away from this discussion just briefly to mention that we do have a significant upcoming event, and that's the Amnesty International Regina Group annual meeting, and that'll be on Thursday, April 24th. It'll be at the United Way at 6:30. We're going to actually have it as a dessert potluck, and people are more than welcome to come out who share an interest in the variety of things that we work on in terms of human rights issues. We'll be Skyping in for a portion of the meeting. Hamid Ghashami Shal, who is a Canadian citizen, who's also an Iranian citizen, who spent 5 years in death row in Evin prison. And he, fortunately, we were campaigning on his behalf, and fortunately in his instance, we were successful. He was released last fall and returned to Toronto, where he lives with his wife. But I'd like to just encourage anybody who has an interest to drop into the meeting. It's, as I say, April 24th at 6:30 at the United Way. So are we sort of at that point, Jim, in terms of the time where we need to take our break?
Well, we're slightly early, but I don't think that's a big problem.
Okay.
So, and we've got some music that Barzan has selected, so we'll have some special music after we finish the break, so, and then we'll continue our discussion.
Great. We'll be right back.
harbelim der mughlajiyan
Lekin sherri tuğlanan harbelim der mughlajiyan Hatı faraz banin gel Dişi dişiye Ege dişi dişiye Ege
So Barzan, you picked that. What's the title of that particular piece there?
It's Biji Yapake, which if you translate to English, it means long life Yapake, or in other words, long life the People's Protection Units.
I noticed there were a lot of women in these videos that were training for military service action sort of thing. They looked very prepared.
Yeah, so basically the song's saying long life Yapage, YPG, for fighting for our freedom, for fighting for our human rights, and it's time that it's our revolution, it's time we have peace and democracy.
So are these people, they're in Kurdistan, are they, or was that a different part of the world?
I am not sure where this video took in place, but if you go to the Kurdish part of Syria right now, there actually is real training like that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, human rights criticized the YPG for training soldiers under the age of 18. But they actually, they have interviews on internet where human rights groups itself interviewed people and interviewed their mothers who were under the age of 18, and they asked them, and their mother said that they wanted to join on their own will because they had a duty of responsibility to protect their country, to protect their human rights.
Right.
And many people, like I've watched interviews, and many people are saying, like, what's the point? I'm a 17-year-old girl. What's the point for me to go to school when my country's in war, when I don't have human rights? Like, why? What's the point for me to sit in a classroom when I don't have basic human rights, when my language is not accepted, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's something hard to imagine here.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But when you're in that situation, it's lots of different things happen.
Yeah.
It's just you're,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, we were talking just before the break about the situation in Syria, and I was talking about how the terrible conflict that has affected so many people of all kinds of backgrounds in terms of people who have been killed and or have had to leave the country as refugees and in the countries. Would most of the Kurdish people who have had to leave ended up in Iraq, or would they have had opportunities to get to other countries in the region as well?
Most of them, they ended up in Iraq, but there's also other Kurdish people who are residing in Turkey, in Lebanon, and other countries. So it's basically you are scheming for your life. But for example, like the border between the Kurdistan region of Iraq and the Kurdish region of Syria, it's like there used to be like issues with it, right? And they would take days for them to go in and out. So much people found it easier to go, for example, into Turkey or into Jordan. But a significant number of the Kurdish population who escaped Syria, they went into the Iraq's Kurdish region.
So the scale of people who have had to leave and go into Lebanon is just amazing.
Yeah. You
know, of all backgrounds.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how that country is beginning to cope with the number of refugees who are there.
Yeah, and it's, for example, it's hard too because Hezbollah has a major... is a major player in Syria too, right? So I mean, if you're going against Hezbollah, like there's actually the war in Syria is spilling into parts of Lebanon as well, because Hezbollah is defending the Syrian regime while at the same time this Lebanese government is not defending the Syrian regime. So it's kind of issue right now of, you know, who's the major player in Syria, whether it be the Lebanese government or the Hezbollah.
I was looking at an initiative that Amnesty is involved with, along with other organizations, for example, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Network and Human Rights Watch and Reporters Without Borders. They've launched fairly recently a Free Syrian Voices website. That's what it's called, freesyrianvoices.org. And what it's trying to do is shed light on the plight of people who are Syrian civil society activists, including people who might be human rights defenders, media, and humanitarian workers, and who are targeted for their work simply for peaceful activism. One of the people who is referred to is a person who is a Kurdish writer, and he was detained 2.5 years ago, and I believe is you'll be able to help me with this, but is it Hussein Hazawa?
Hussein Hazawa, yeah.
Thank you. Okay. And, you know, this just one example of somebody who has been detained in Syria for quite a long time. There's real concern about what's happening to these people who have been involved in just simply human rights work and involved with civil society or humanitarian organizations in Syria. But... I'd recommend people explore that website. Say it's called freesyrianvoices.org. So we've kind of covered Iraq a bit and Syria, but there's also Kurdish people in Iran. Yeah. And did you want to talk about that a little bit in terms of what they're facing on a day-to-day basis as well?
Well, in Iran, for example, there was elections a couple of months ago, and they have a new president right now, Rouhani. And Rouhani is actually worse than the president before, because Rouhani, there's been many executions going on, and many of these executions have been prosecuting the Kurdish people, and mainly because the Kurdish people are trying to stand up for their rights the same way as Syria is, or the same way as Iraq is. So there's been many executions going on now.
Right.
And they're trying to change the significant number of Kurds in the Kurdish areas and moving them to other Kurdish to other Iranian areas to decrease the amount of the number of the Kurdish areas.
So that's one of the concerns that Amnesty identified actually in a recent report just issued a few weeks ago. It's a global report on the use of the death penalty around the world. They noted that Iran actually is responsible for the second highest number of executions of any country.
Yeah.
And we're aware that over 40 people were executed in Iran in January alone of this year, and likely the number's higher, but we're conscious of that number. So, you know, that it's a real significant issue in terms of human rights in that particular country. And I guess the other country in the region is... where there's significant numbers of people, obviously, is Turkey.
Turkey, too, yeah.
Yeah.
And Turkey, last year at the March 21st, well, actually before that, but we're just going to say approximately March 21st, which is the Kurdish New Year's, Nowruz. Mm-hmm. The Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan had made a peace agreement with the Turkish government to stop the war, the guerrilla war that's been going on between the Kurdistan Workers Party and between the Turkish government. Now, a year from that, and the Turkish government has been taking slow steps towards that. Like, for example, our guerrilla fighters have pulled out of the mountains. They're looking, establishing peace agreements with Turkey, but Turkey's taking slow steps. So there's a question of whether is Turkey really ready to accept the Kurds as a nation? Because our main demands is release all political prisoners, have our freedom in, you know, speaking our language, have education in our own language, you know, accepting Kurdistan Workers Party as a party and not a terrorist organization, accept the Kurdish nation as a nation and not terrorists. Mm-hmm. So there's many conflicts with that. And one of the things that we demand is Kurdish to become an official language of Turkey. Since one third of our population, of Kurdish population in Turkey, is in Turkey, so mm-hmm. we demand that Kurdish become an official language of Turkey.
So there were elections actually quite recently yes. in Turkey, and you know, in the lead up to the elections, yes. one of the things people here might be interested in is, because not everybody will be aware of this, but the Turkish president actually shut down Twitter in Turkey. In advance of the election.
Yeah, because I am not sure if it's real or not, but there had been videos, audio files of the prime minister leaking out on YouTube and Twitter and stuff that the prime minister had tried to steal money from the country and saying put it in the banks or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the prime minister did that. But the prime minister blocked YouTube and stuff. But his excuse was that the opposition is trying to mislead the revolution and he doesn't want that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was undemocratic and that was beyond...
Well,
you know,
significant limits on freedom of speech.
Yes, freedom of speech, basically, yes.
In Turkey itself yeah. and in the lead up to the election. And, you know, one of the reports I did see was that it really was in part targeted against the Kurdish social media.
Definitely, because the Peace and Democracy Party, the BDP, they're trying to spread, you know, their influence on people outside of the, you know, Kurdish diaspora too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they want as much people as possible to support them
mm-hmm.
outside of the country too. So basically because they want a peace agreement with Turkey. Mm-hmm. But the real question is... Well, is Turkey ready to accept the Kurds as a nation? Because when you're accepting the Kurds as a nation, you have to recognize that Kurdish is the official language. That's the basic. That's one of our basic human rights.
Mm-hmm.
Because not long ago, not until even 1995, you can be straight into prison for speaking Kurdish.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, Barzan, one of the interesting things that I thought you were talking about just a few minutes ago is that there was, you know, an initiative where people who are Kurdish, who are guerrillas in Turkey
yeah.
had come to the conclusion that it was time to initiate peace discussions.
Yes.
You know, and I like the sound of that. It reflects back to the long, long conflict in Northern Ireland where
yeah.
people were in significant conflict and you know, at the point where people decided to go a different direction, you know, things became more peaceful in that country. And clearly, you know, that's a difficult process to go through yeah. in terms of, because you're left with lots and lots of anxieties on both sides.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And people have to yeah. get to know each other and get to know how to live in peace again. But it's not an easy process to get through.
No, definitely it's not easy, but it's up to Turkey to decide whether they want peace or not, because peace begins with Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have made other peace agreements with Turkey, and they have scratched it and said they've started war with our guerrillas. Mm-hmm. So, for example, our guerrillas are saying Turkey needs to start taking serious steps.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you can't take little steps. You need to take serious steps because it's been a year and there's been not much progress.
Mm-hmm.
So for the peace agreement to work, you have to take big steps. We're not saying take 10 big steps in one day. We're mm-hmm. saying maybe take one big step in 6 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those big steps, as I mentioned, was recognizing the Kurdish language, at least a regional language, mm-hmm. if not official language of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. And was that peace agreement, you might say, supported by the international community? Or how much
yes,
role
definitely,
did the...
Definitely, the Americans played a role. The Americans tried to tell Turkey that you have to work with it. The European Union said that Turkey must recognize the Kurdish nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a must. It's not that Turkey has to or has not to. They have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why, like, Turkey wants to become part of the European Union. But it's not possible for them, because how can you become a part of the European Union when you don't recognize the Kurdish rights?
Right.
Part of the European Union is they're not going to accept any country that's not democratic.
Right.
So
is that whole discussion about, you know, the Kurdish nation, it's not necessarily about establishing a distinct nation, recognizing the language rights and other things with respect to the Kurdish people.
Yes.
Is that a correct understanding? I mean, you know, in Canada, there's talk about the, not necessarily everybody who is in Quebec wants to separate, but they want some recognition about the Quebecois nation.
Yes, I am.
And you know, there's obviously a debate that goes on, and there's elections in Quebec and all the rest, but how use of the notion of nation and nationhood in the context of the Kurdish people in Turkey and other countries, I'm sure there's discussions about it.
Yes. Well, it's a dream of every Kurd to live in an independent state,
mm-hmm.
an independent Kurdish state. But what needs to be understood is our people are actually fighting for basic human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the reason why these countries like Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria are not giving rights to Kurds is because they say if we give enough rights to them, they're going to slowly, gradually build up a country.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not deniable. I mean, if you look at the Kurdish region of Iraq, eventually it's going to split up from Iraq, eventually. Eventually it's going to be an independent state. And eventually United States has to come to terms with the Kurds that they now officially recognize the Kurds as an independent nation. Eventually that day will come. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, maybe 5 years from today, but eventually what America needs to understand is that day is going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the world needs to be ready to recognize the Kurds as a nation. And if that day comes, then that's going to have a lot of influence on the Kurds in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to say, if the Kurds in Iraq were successful in establishing a state, why can't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why can't we have autonomous region? And gradually, if you have autonomous regions, they break away from the country if they're successful.
Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing...
Yes, yeah, yes.
Peace.
Yes, and definitely Iraq, like, my prediction is Iraq is going to split into three parts, Sunni, Shia, and the Kurds.
Really?
Because right now it's dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have an area which, like, for example, the Kurdistan region has been prosperous and peaceful for the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Iraq, there's, like, car bombs, the government is so corrupt. Whereas in terms of the Kurdistan region, it's more prosperous, and it's more peaceful, it's more economically boomed. So then how can you have a region that's economic boomed, it's peace and has prosperity, a part of a failed state?
Mm-hmm.
So Iraq is a failed state, basically.
And would the people who are in the rest of Iraq, who are either Sunni or Shia, is that a discussion that's going on, particularly about the idea of each of those groups having their own region?
What the Arabs want is, for example, the Sunnis want to create their own autonomous region too.
Uh-huh.
But in my view, that's not going to work, because
mm-hmm.
as long as the current prime minister is in power, that's totally impossible. Even for the Kurdistan region, it's struggling to keep their power because the central Iraqi government wants to have power over the Kurdistan region. One of the issues that I mentioned was cutting the budget of the Kurdistan region 17%.
So have we covered the key countries in the Middle East by, in terms of the discussion we've had so far?
Yes.
Where the Kurdish people are? We talked about Iraq, Syria. We've talked about Turkey and Iran. Are there any other ones of particular notes, for example, Egypt, where there's any significant population of Kurdish people?
Lebanon also has a significant population of Kurds, but not that many, probably 150,000 to 200,000.
Where is that? I'm sorry.
Lebanon.
Oh, okay.
But they're actually, from reports that I've been reading, they're actually enjoying, like, they don't have any concerns in terms of human rights.
And would they have been there in Lebanon for quite a long time?
Yes, quite a long time, yes.
And fairly well integrated into the communities
there. Into the community, into the culture, yes. And they also have a political party known as the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that political party is active still, but a couple of years ago I read something that there's a party, Kurdistan Democratic Party of Lebanon, which unites all the Kurdish people of Lebanon.
I'm just curious, Barzan, because one of the big problems in Iraq is the split between the Sunnis and the Shias.
Yes.
And there actually are more Shias than... No, yes, there are more Shias in Iraq than there are Sunnis. And in recent history, up until the time of Saddam, the Sunnis had the power.
Yes. Yeah.
And now the tables have turned, and now the Shias are in power.
Yes.
Now, I'm just wondering if there's a similar kind of dynamic going on in Kurdistan. Do you have that same kind of religious splits, or are you more, as a Muslim people, are you more unified as far as the religious thought goes?
I am not Muslim. I consider myself more Kurdish. My religion is Yazidi, but I respect all religions. In the Kurdistan region, since 2005, Masoud Barzani has been the current president of the Kurdistan region, and we actually had a turn of tables between two major political parties, the KDP, Kurdistan Democratic Party, and the PUK, Patriotic Union of Party, having premium partnership in the government, for example, having a prime minister every 2 years. But now we're trying to establish a government where one party dominates one government for 4 years.
I guess I'm a little confused here. I thought that all that region was basically Muslim. So you're not a Muslim?
No,
here.
I am not Muslim, no.
Oh.
In Kurdistan, we have Christians, we have Yazidis, we have Muslims, we have Jewish, we have all kinds of diversity, Assyrianis, and we have respect for them. And that's the difference between Iraq and Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
In Iraq, you don't have respect for religion. And they want... I guess the main thing is Iraqi government right now, because it is Shia, they want to dominate into a Sharia Islamic law. They're shifting away from a federalism to Islamic Sharia law, similar to what's in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And our people are not ready to accept that. Our people are actually not ready... not going to accept that at all, because you have Yazidis, you have Muslims, you have Christians, Assyrianis.
I can see I have some research to do here. I've never heard of Yazidis before.
Yeah, they're a Kurdish religion too. So.
Okay, so is it related to Islam or
no? Not
it's totally
different. They have their own rules, rituals.
Wow. Okay.
They have their own temple, and there's also Zoroastrianism, which is predominantly in the Kurdish region of Iran, where they have their own temple and stuff. So if you look at the Kurdistan like in terms of the whole region, Kurdistan has always had a respect and tolerance for religion. Long time ago, even before Saddam Hussein was in power, even before the state of Iraq was established, the Kurdish people lived side by side peacefully, respecting all kinds of religions and living side by side peacefully. And that's the difference with Iraq. Iraq does not know how to live peacefully.
You know, I don't know whether this is just a thought that people have had, but it just seems like generations ago, maybe hundreds of years ago, all these different beliefs coexisted side by side peacefully. And you have to ask yourself, what has happened here? Is it money that's the money and power that split people up on?
Definitely,
it?
money and power. Corruption, money and power. I mean, if you look at it from one side, the Iraqi prime minister, you know, like, he has been controlling all the power in Iraq. Interior minister, he basically has control all over the Iraq's oil. So basically, you can call him the oil minister. I mean, he has ministers for that. Mm-hmm. He has appointed ministers for that. But if you have him controlling all the power and telling these ministers what to do, then basically he controls all these minister positions because he's dictating to them what to do. Those ministers don't have a lot of power in their own hands.
Hmm. See, there's some similarities I see there in our own government.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So,
Barzan, this has been a really wonderful discussion to have you on the program today. I hope our listeners who are tuning in have found it as interesting as I have. A lot of good information, and I hope at some point we'll be able to have you back. And you know, someday that there will be more positive news for the Kurdish people in that region, but also everyone in that region. It's in particular, in the last few years, it's been a tough time for people living in, as you say, in particularly Iraq and Syria and those particular countries. So thank you so much for being on the program today, Barzan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. And I just, if I can, I'll just mention a few more of the upcoming events we've got to highlight in the last few minutes of the program. And I'll give you a chance before we close the show, Jim, to plug the lottery again, too. But I'd mentioned before the break that the Regina Group annual meeting is an open meeting. It's on Thursday, April 24th. It's the Amnesty International Community Group annual meeting. It's at 6:30 at the United Way. The information's on our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca. And also there you'll find some information about other upcoming events that we've got that will be happening quite quickly. A very significant one is Amnesty Canada has a webinar that people are able to participate in for free. It'll be coming up on May 7th. It's a webinar that will be talking about strategies related to the upcoming international or global campaign to stop the use of torture. And that's a growing concern around the world, and we'll be talking about that throughout the next little while. Another one that I'd encourage everybody, particularly folks in Saskatchewan who are tuning in, is we're very excited to be hosting a first-ever regional Amnesty International activist webinar here in Saskatchewan. It will be on Wednesday, May 14th at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it's free to participate. People will need to go online and register for it, but we've got all the information posted on our website too. So, Jim, with that, I'm just going to throw it back. You can mention the lottery one more time quickly, and thanks again, Barzan.
Thank you so much.
It's going to have to be really fast.
All right.
and I encourage everybody to find a program or come down to the radio station, buy your ticket. It's only $20, and you can win a trip for two to New York, or you get a $1,000 travel voucher, or the relaxing getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa. I've got tickets for sale, and lots of other programmers do too, so make sure. Don't delay. Don't find out that they've sold out and you don't have your chance. So we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a reality for the world's people, will our work be done?"